From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, high school students hold the national school walkout protesting gun violence and school shootings.
I think that our politicians have been way too slow to act and that they haven't even done enough. You know, giving us a platform is not enough.
We will not support any politician who allows this violence to continue in our schools, in our streets, in our communities. We will not support it. We will vote them out.
Plus, more than a century later, it still impacts relations between the U.S. and Canada. The Great Halifax Explosion.
2,000 are dead in a split second. It was one-fifth the power of the atomic bomb dropped on Hiroshima.
Plus, the gamble a Michigan-born opera singer took as he went from mezzo-soprano to tenor.
The conclusion basically was that I wouldn't be able to sing anymore professionally. But I basically didn't accept no for an answer.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. All across the country, students and some teachers stood up at 10 a.m., walked out of their classrooms, and spent the next 17 minutes honoring the 17 people killed in the Parkland, Florida high school shooting. Many schools in Michigan took part in this national school walkout, demanding action from lawmakers on school safety and guns. The Washtenaw Youth Initiative held a big rally at Riverside Park in Ypsilanti.
End gun violence!
No more violence!
End gun violence!
No justice!
No peace!
No justice!
No peace!
No justice!
No peace!
With us now are Ann Arbor Pioneer High School students, both seniors, Emma Roth and Marquand Kane. Both are members of the Washtenaw Youth Initiative. Emma Roth, welcome to Stateside. Glad to have you with us.
Hi, thank you. It's great to be here.
Emma, how much student participation did you get for the walkout and also for the Riverside Park rally?
The walkout turnout in general was actually phenomenal. We had basically the entire student population of many schools walk out. In terms of the rally, I want to say we had about between 500 and 700 kids here. It's been phenomenal.
So why did you choose to get behind this and help organize this rally?
It's something that needs to happen. I mean, I think we as a society have been complacent for far too long on far too many issues. And with the recent Parkland shooting, I think the students in Parkland really galvanized the nation. And it's so important that we all stand up and speak for what we believe in. And things need to change. We need to take a stand. We, as many people today said, we are youth voices, and we need to make our voices heard.
Emma, how would you rate the response by national and state lawmakers to the Florida high school shooting and the ones that preceded it?
Well, given that the laws in general have not really changed, I would say that it's not great. A lot of it has been thoughts and prayers, and frankly, we can't accept that. That's not an acceptable answer. Thoughts and prayers don't really do anything. It's laws that do things. And that's what we're pushing for. We had students here register to vote today. We are here to put pressure on our lawmakers because they need to help us change things. We need our laws to change. So I think, really, their response has been thoughts and prayers, and that's not enough.
And when you talk about we want changes in laws, Emma, what are the changes that you want to see at the state and the national level for school safety and for gun control?
No guns in schools, period. Teachers absolutely should not be armed. The Washtenaw Youth Initiative also stands for police in schools to not be armed. We also believe that they should have implicit bias training. No one under the age of 21 should be allowed to purchase a firearm. We also think we should ban assault-style weapons because you don't... Assault-style weapons literally are weapons to kill someone else, a person. They're not for hunting. You don't need something like that to hunt. There are other guns that you can use. So that's our like state and national platform. On a specific Washtenaw County level, we are looking for gun buyback programs in our schools. We are looking, and in part for police demilitarization and implicit bias training required for the police.
You know, there have been, sad to say, many school shootings in this country, but the level of student activism and resistance after Parkland is something very different. Why do you think that is, Emma?
I think it's because at this point we know the survivors' names. I think often we talk about the victims' names, but these teenagers, they really stood up and they made themselves known, they made themselves heard, and they have really started something incredible. I think it comes down to the students who made their voices heard.
And so as we see this resistance building and seeing, you know, what happened today with walkout and the rally, what do you think this may mean among 18-year-olds who can vote this November? What message will you and other 18-year-olds be sending at the ballot box?
We will not support any politician who allows this violence to continue in our schools, in our streets, in our communities. We will not support it. We will vote them out. We are here to do that, and that is what we will do.
Students like you all across the country, I've been looking at pictures and videos, are holding up signs saying enough is enough.
Yes.
What do you hope that means going forward? What kind of change do you believe you will affect in our country, Emma?
Many student speakers touched on this today, that we want the Parkland shooting, and although actually it's been proven that it hasn't, we want it to be the last school shooting. We don't want any more school shootings. We don't believe that students should be shot. It's disgusting, frankly. Enough is enough in terms of school shootings, in terms of children being shot in general. We want that to change. We want our laws to change to protect us.
So, Marquand, why did you choose to walk out and be a part of today's rally?
Yeah, as I noted today, it's a 2-year death anniversary of a dear family friend of ours. His name was Kyan. He was just walking down the street, and you know, he got hit by a stray bullet, and he was killed on sight. And so, really, I'm here to talk about our community and how we need healing and unity within it. You know, I'm at school, and every single day I'm getting a good text from someone to say, you know, watch your back, man, because all these schools are being put on lockdown from all these school shooting and bomb threats. You know. It's sickening. You know, I can't even enjoy an education, and my friends can't, and neither can my little brother and sister, and I'm worried about it. I'm very worried. I'm glad everyone showed up today, but this should have been, we should have mobilized way before this.
Marquand, how would you rate the response by national and state lawmakers to the Florida high school shooting and all the ones that preceded it?
Yeah, I believe that some politicians have definitely given students a platform and a voice. They've definitely been helpful in our efforts to be able to have our voice heard here. And so I can say we've been welcomed generally by our community. We have received support. But what I'm hearing around the country is that not many students are. Several of these students are being criticized, and we're being told that we're too young and that we don't know what we're talking about. And that's completely ridiculous. I think that our politicians have been way too slow to act and that they haven't even done enough. You know, giving us a platform is not enough, and this is a symptom of a much larger issue. It's what happens when our politicians are bought off by the NRA, by Big Pharma, and by Big Oil. You know, they're very slow to react, and I'm not impressed with their responses whatsoever.
Marquand, when you think about this day, about the rally that you were just a part of at Riverside Park, and just the whole movement of the National School Walkout today, what was the most important moment for you today?
The most important moment for me today, it actually happened before the rally even. I was about to walk out the door, and I stopped and paused, and I looked at my little sister, and I gave her a hug. And I had a conversation with her. You know, it was a very short conversation, but I talked to her, and, you know, I asked her if she felt safe at school. I asked her, what did she think about what was happening? But that's probably the most important thing, because while this issue is impacting me, it's going to be even worse for my younger sister. You know, I'm a senior year. I'm in my senior year. I'm going to be out of high school soon. I'm not going to have to worry about my school being targeted necessarily, but she is. That was the most important thing, but definitely seeing our community getting out here today and mobilizing and caring about the issue and sticking through it all, even when it was cold in this weather, that was also very dear to me too. You know, I'm very impressed with our group.
Marquand, it's very sad to say there have been many other school shootings in this country, but after Parkland, this level of student activism and a sense of resistance, it's much different. Why do you think that is?
I mean, there's just been so many shootings and there's been so many threats. I think that this one in particular, you know, it's just with the high number of students who had died in the scenario, with the Parkland victims having courage to come out and speak out about the issue. You know, they set the precedent for us, and they were the standard, and they were the ones who were leading this charge, and we owe it to them. I think that their response definitely showed our other youth in this country the power that we can have if we mobilize and try to have our voice heard. You know, they were fearless. I believe that we owe it a lot to the Parkland victims.
I know students like you all across the country were rallying and holding up signs saying enough is enough. What do you hope that will mean going forward?
Enough is enough. I hope that means that we don't just gather here today because this was a symbolic day to walk out. I hope it wasn't a facade. I hope we care more about this issue than on any random day. By enough is enough. I mean, I hope we stand up when we mobilize and we take it upon ourselves, the initiative to keep moving forward with the progress that we need to have, that we need to make in our community. And as I said today, this wasn't just about gun violence. And there's it's no surprise our politicians are slow to act. You know, this is a symptom of a much larger problem here in America. America is sick. Our country is sick morally. We have elected leaders without morals and without ethics, and we're seeing the ramifications of that today. You know, there are millions of people in this country without access to healthcare. You know, we spend more on a military budget than we do on school. We spend more on incarceration than we do on school. There are all sorts of problems happening in this country. And I think that with this issue being highlighted today and with the students talking about how our politicians were bought off by the NRA, hopefully we'll also start to talk about Big Pharma and their role in the opioid epidemic in this country, and also with climate change, you know, with the big oil companies lobbying our politicians. That's what I hope that means by enough is enough. It's not just gun violence plaguing our country, but it is several, and I hope we care enough to realize that.
Marquand, I do have to ask you, what about the Second Amendment? You know, there are many Americans who feel very, very strongly that that is an important part of our constitutional freedom, and it must be preserved. What do you say to that?
Well, I believe that citizens in general should have a right to bear arms, and believe that we should have, you know, and I don't believe that all firearms should just be banned. That's not what I believe in. But I don't like the fact that our citizens have access to military-grade weapons, and more than that, I don't like that a government does either. And I believe that if we're going to tell citizens that they should disarm themselves too, then I believe we need to take a look at our police forces and say the same thing, because the government should only be equally as armed as its citizenry. Otherwise, that corruption happens, and quite frankly, under the Trump administration, I don't trust the government enough not to protect myself and to bear arms. It's a very difficult issue, but hopefully through it all, we'll come to some sort of reality and understanding that lives are more valuable than these guns. And if we cannot live to enjoy these rights, then they don't even matter at all. If we can't live to enjoy them, if my little brother and sister, you know, can't get an education, then they don't matter at all.
Marquand Kane and Emma Roth are seniors at Pioneer High School in Ann Arbor. They were part of today's National School Walkout on the one-month anniversary of the Florida high school shooting, and they organized a rally for all Washtenaw County high schools. Still to come, the trans opera singer who went from mezzo-soprano to tenor.
Being a mezzo-soprano has brought me quite a lot that I never would have been able to see if I had been born as a tenor.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
I've sent the following wire to President Truman. My heartiest congratulations to you on your election.
I'm aware of my blackness, but I don't go around and look and see whether I'm different than someone else.
Fail a lot quickly, and then eventually you'll succeed.
I worry that the person who thought up Muzak may be thinking up something else.
Leaping from branch to branch, burying nuts and acorns, teasing a backyard dog by staying just out of reach. Let's face it, squirrels are so common in Michigan, it's easy for us to take their presence for granted. But just as Holden Caulfield worried about where the ducks go in winter, we got to wondering, where do squirrels go during winter? Do they cluster up in some hibernation hole or perhaps join Michigan's snowbirds and head towards warmer locales? It's Wednesday, which means it's time to talk our state's history with our partners at the Michigan History Center. And with us today, State Archivist Mark Harvey. Welcome back, Mark.
Thank you.
The observation of squirrels, I guess, have been going on since there were humans here in this region. But do we know when the first written account was?
Well, I tried to go as far back as I could on this one. That usually leads me to looking at the Jesuit relations, and they actually talk about squirrels and the squirrel nation or the squirrel tribe in 1651 in New France. Now, that's a little further north than we currently are, but it's in the general region of Lower Ontario. Lewis and Clark also wrote about them in 1803, swimming the Ohio River, headed south, and then we have lots of written references after that in Michigan proper.
In fact, people observed some pretty intense and huge squirrel migrations. Tell us about those.
Well, I don't know where to start, Cynthia.
Unusual
topic.
It is. And I mean, even the idea of, as you say, Lewis and Clark observing squirrels swimming across the river in great amounts. And so where were these chatterboxes migrating from, where to where?
There's all sorts of accounts of them. It starts with some 19th century accounts in Michigan where people relied on them as a source of food and then clothing because there were so many of them. They literally had to beat them back with clubs. There's actually a written account that farmers were forced to harvest squirrels in order to protect their crops and barns, up to killing up to 20,000 squirrels within a week.
Wow. Okay, that's pretty heavy. So for food and clothing, a very rich source for these early settlers.
Yep.
And then what about these migrations and going across the river? And even after the Mackinac Bridge opened, did I understand that the squirrels would be walking across the bridge?
Yeah. So starting in 1851, the residents of Holland, Michigan dubbed it the year of the squirrel, quote unquote, because the squirrels were just devastating their crops and gardens in biblical proportion. And then there's accounts in 1866 in the Saginaw Valley, 1922 in decades after up at the Straits, and then 1986 on the Garden Peninsula in the UP, 2004 in Grand Haven. So you mentioned the bridge. There was a gentleman up there, a Youper named Don Densmore, that started noticing them in 1922 trying to swim north across the Straits, which is a perilous swim under the best of circumstances.
So not an entirely successful swim by these squirrels, I must imagine.
No, the swim range is around, for a squirrel, is around 2 miles. Mm. And the birds would harass him. And so maybe some made it, but most of them just drowned and washed back up on shore. And then they got wise because in 1957, the year the bridge opened, they saw that span as a way to cross the water without swimming. And it got to be such a problem that bridge workers had to, quote-unquote, remove them, which probably usually meant shooting them off the bridge, to keep them from being a traffic hazard. So it's hard enough for a motorist to cross that bridge without dodging squirrels. And I don't know, you know, it's been a while since I've been on the Labor Day bridge walk, so maybe they're inconspicuously trying to work their way into that event.
Do we know when the last big squirrel migration was in Michigan?
The last recorded one that was reported was the one in 2004 in Grand Haven, Michigan. And there was lots of confusion initially over that because people found dozens of dead squirrels floating in the Grand River and washing up on the Lake Michigan beaches. And officials thought there was a disease issue or maybe a mass poisoning, but all the lab reports came back negative and it was determined they had just drowned.
Were they trying to get away from winter? Were they trying to come back here when the weather was warm? What do we think was going on with these big migrations?
So I talked to the Michigan DNR biologist, Adam Bump, and pretty much put the question to him. And he said the word migration really needs air quotes around it, because that usually implies movement due to weather over long distances. And what, as near as they can tell, the phenomenon is pretty much the province of the gray squirrel. And the best explanation is that during food abundance, the squirrel populations increase to a point that depletes all their resources and or triggers a behavior to get them to move on to greener pastures.
Hmm. Okay. And the point that you make about gray squirrels leads me to wonder just how many types of squirrels make their home in Michigan. And the reason I'll ask this is I grew up in Oakland County in Ferndale, southern Oakland County, and all we ever had were those little like reddish orange squirrels. And my first big job out of college, 1976, I was over in Grosse Pointe and I went, look at these black squirrels. We never had them in Ferndale, but they've moved because now if you drive through Ferndale, they are there. So how many kinds of squirrels do we have?
It's a bit of a trick question because squirrels covers everything from a woodchuck to chipmunks to other types of ground squirrels to flying squirrels. Which are flying squirrels, or a type of tree squirrel. So I think most people commonly, when they speak of a squirrel, they're thinking of a tree squirrel. And yes, in Michigan, there's three main ones. The red squirrel, which you mentioned, which are a little bit smaller. Some people call them boomers because they're so loud.
Okay.
The fox squirrel and the gray squirrel.
So is the black squirrel that I saw in Grosse Pointe when I first started working, is that actually the gray squirrel?
Yeah, that is a black phase gray squirrel. And I have to tell you, whenever I correct somebody on that, no one appreciates the difference of the... And I grew up in East Lansing, and there was a very distinct pocket of them in East Lansing. And if you went a few miles to the west in Lansing, you would not see them. So I think they're just pocketed around the state with that black color factor.
There we go. So back to the original question, where do Michigan squirrels go during the winter?
Well, actually, nowhere. They don't hibernate. They just hang out eating their cache of food, trying to stay warm and not driving each other nuts.
There you go, or us as well.
Yeah.
Well, that is it. All you ever wanted to know about squirrels going nuts here in Michigan. Mark Harvey, State Archivist with the Michigan History Center. Thank you so much for biting into this nut of squirrel migration.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Here is your choice. continue on your journey to becoming a singer using the voice you were born with, or risk losing that voice, possibly your career, in order to live an authentic life. That is the choice opera singer Holden Madagami faced. He trained at the University of Michigan School of Music, Theater, and Dance, trained as a mezzo-soprano. That recital was recorded as Holden, who was assigned female at birth, was singing as a mezzo-soprano. But about 4 years ago, Holden came out as trans. And after a difficult and risky journey, here is Holden today, a tenor. Holden Madagami is with us now via Skype from Germany. It's a pleasure to welcome you to Stateside, Holden.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let me quote from a piece that you wrote about yourself for Britain's Independent. And here's what you wrote. I'm 27, Native American, queer and transgender. I'm also a tenor who used to be a mezzo-soprano. So your love of singing, serious singing, goes back way before you came out as trans. Now, you grew up in Gaylord?
Yes, I did, yeah.
And when and how did you discover opera?
It's a funny story because when I was a kid, I really wanted to be a video game designer, and I didn't plan on singing at all, but a choir teacher roped me into the choir class because I played a bit of piano, and I found out that I was good at it. I took some lessons with the choir teacher at our high school. I became very quickly obsessed with everything to do with music, conducting and theory and opera specifically. Because she gave me an aria from an opera, and it just kind of went from there.
What do you think it was about opera that grabbed you? It's not everybody's cup of tea.
I think what it was about opera, I think it was the stories and the characters, which you can get from theater and you can get from musical theater, but it's the kind of sweeping emotion that underlies everything that these characters have to say. It's so much more than what they're saying most of the time. Half of what they're saying is in the orchestra. That's what I found really exciting.
And so there you wind up at the University of Michigan training as a mezzo-soprano. Describe for us just exactly what a mezzo-soprano voice is. What's the vocal range?
Sure. So a mezzo-soprano is a lower female voice range. So a soprano is the highest, mezzo-soprano sits a little bit lower, but often has the exact same range or a very similar range to a soprano, but they just sound better in a little bit lower range. A really good example of a mezzo-soprano is Lady Gaga. Even though she's not a classical singer, she is a very good pop singer, and she has kind of a lower female range. That's a really good example of a mezzo-soprano in popular culture.
So there you are training away, graduated, right, from the University of Michigan. Your first professional performance after graduating from U of M was what?
My first professional performance was The Marriage of Figaro with Arbor Opera Theater, and I played Cherubino. It was my dream role at the time. I'd been wanting to do that role since I was in high school, so it was kind of a dream come true.
In the meantime, so you've got these other changes taking place in your life and realizing that you wanted to come out as trans. And that was a risk, wasn't it? Because of your voice and the way you wanted to make your living and what that would mean to your voice. Talk about that.
You're exactly right. It was a huge decision to make because at the time when I was deciding to come out as trans, deciding whether I wanted to take testosterone, which was the first huge decision I wanted to make, there wasn't really any research as to the effects of testosterone on the classical singing voice. There had been a few articles on the internet, and I had kind of talked to a couple of people, but the conclusion basically was that I wouldn't be able to sing anymore professionally. But I basically didn't accept no for an answer. I talked to some other teachers, and there was one teacher at the University of Michigan that I sent an email, and I was just in a bit of a state. And she replied very calmly. And she said, Holden, I think you should just go ahead and do it. And maybe you'll be a tenor. And how exciting is that?
And that was such the right thing at the right time, wasn't it?
Absolutely. It was exactly what I needed to hear. I needed someone's permission, really, because I was scared.
And then you found the place to find your tenor voice, the Glyndebourne Academy in the UK. Talk about that place.
The Glyndebourne Academy it's a very new program. It's basically for singers with non-traditional career paths. And everybody comes from different places financially and experience-wise. Everybody has a different story, really. And Glyndebourne itself is a world-class international opera house. As far as I'm concerned, it's the highest standard of opera that we can come to, besides the Metropolitan Opera in New York. They're really at the same level, but very different places. The Glyndebourne Academy is a place where I think 9 singers could go and basically get some tender love and care to their voices, their artistry. We talked about acting and body movement, dancing, how to work in a chorus, how to learn music correctly, Italian diction, English diction, stylistic things, all sorts of things. And primarily I was looking for vocal technique help because I'm going through a major voice change. So,
And you had this new tenor voice that did not have the skills that you had when you were training as a mezzo-soprano.
Exactly. It's a completely different instrument, to be honest. I still have a lot of the same abilities, and I was a good student, and so I know how to practice, and I know how to look at technique, but it's kind of starting from the ground up.
And you did, and you found your tenor voice, and you are now singing as a tenor. How do you feel now? There are very few artists that can say, well, I was this, and now I am that. What do they lend to each other? Like, what did being a mezzo-soprano and being able to attack a role that way, what did that bring to you now as a tenor?
That's a very good question. I think being a mezzo-soprano has brought me quite a lot that I never would have been able to see if I had been, for lack of a better way to put it, born as a tenor. Because as a mezzo-soprano, I'm mostly focused on the tone of my kind of lower middle range. I focused a lot on diction. I focused a lot on stagecraft and artistry. I of course, focused on the voice, but it was really different. But now as a tenor, coming from that background of being a mezzo-soprano, I have all of this wealth of knowledge of stagecraft and artistry and diction and languages, and the attention to detail that I took as a mezzo-soprano has only helped me as a tenor. I don't just think about what my high notes sound like, which of course is important too, because those need to sound pretty.
Sure.
But, there's so much more to it. And I'm so thankful that I had the experience of not having to worry about high notes as a mezzo-soprano.
And you did look around very hard, didn't you, for anyone in the opera singing world who had done what you wanted to do, you know, to take testosterone, and you look for trans male singers, and so you didn't find anybody. So are you feeling that sense of really forging a path, a new path?
I really am. Yeah, it's a bit scary. I didn't want to admit it for a while. I was like, oh, there must be other people out there, which I think there are, but I just... I couldn't find them. They weren't visible to me. Nobody had come out as a trans singer in my field at the time. So I really think I'm the first one to do it so publicly, at the very least. And I think I'm really, like you said, paving the way for other trans singers who want to go into opera. I already have emails and messages from young trans singers who are just so thankful that I exist and that there is an example of someone that they can be, you know?
Because when you're facing that choice, well, you didn't really feel there was a choice, right? Because you could not continue to go on the way you had been. You felt you did have to make this transition, and you knew you were masculine. So you had to do it. So you were willing to risk the voice.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There wasn't a choice for me because the quality of my life and the quality of my mental health was so poor that I wasn't singing anyway. I was so depressed and dysphoric and unhappy with my gender that there was no other option. I wouldn't have been singing at all if I'd continued that way. So
you rolled the dice and you won because now you have this beautiful tenor voice, and it is absolutely a beautiful, beautiful voice. And is there a point, like right now you are out sharing your story, you're talking to us here, you wrote this terrific piece for The Independent, telling your whole story. Is there a point where you'll be glad to just be Holden Madagame, the tenor, and not the trans opera singer who went from mezzo-soprano to tenor?
That's very astute. Yes, I think at some point I'll get to that point, and I'll be very happy to be at that point. For now, I'm very happy to also be sort of, for lack of a better way of putting it, the face of trans masculine opera singers, and happy to help other people in that way. But it'll be nice when I'm not the trans opera singer when I go into an audition, you know?
Opera singer, tenor, Holden Madagame. Good luck with the productions you're going to be doing in 2018 and with your opera career.
Thank you.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. A century ago, the biggest man-made blast prior to the atomic bomb decimated half of Halifax, Nova Scotia. It killed and injured thousands. Up next, John U. Bacon on his latest book, The Great Halifax Explosion. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Hazel Forrest died last week at age 106. According to the Chronicle Herald, Hazel was one of the last known survivors of the Halifax explosion when two ships collided in Halifax Harbor in 1917. The resulting explosion was the biggest man-made blast prior to the atomic bomb. Some 2,000 people were killed and many thousands more were injured. Yet this cataclysmic event is largely forgotten, at least on the U.S. side of our border with Canada. But John U. Bacon is changing that with his latest book, The Great Halifax Explosion, a World War I story of treachery, tragedy, and extraordinary heroism. I spoke to him when it was published in November. You know, we have talked about your books exploring football and, you know, Michigan sports programs and the mental health struggles of your friend, the late John Saunders of ESPN. Now for something completely different, the Great Halifax Explosion. What turned your attention to this?
Two things. The two sides of my family, the Bacons, were in New York throughout the whole process, the last 200 years. The other side, the Canadian side, went north to New Brunswick. My grandfather was 12 years old in 1917 when this happened. I used to spend my summers in New Brunswick talking to him. He kept on telling me about this, you know, two-ton anchor that went 2 miles this way, another part that went 3 miles that way. And I didn't know what he was talking about. I didn't think he was crazy, but I never heard of it anywhere else until 1999, when I'm researching my first book on the history of University of Michigan hockey. It turns out Michigan's first hockey coach happens to have been a first responder, if you will, to the Halifax explosion. And that's what inspired him to become a doctor, go to U of M, and start Michigan's hockey program.
So you started digging and digging.
I did, and I got lucky and lucky because it turns out his papers, his letters, Joseph Barge was a great letter writer, and his grandchildren who are here in the state, and I know them, they've got his letters from World War I where he served for a year and ended up getting hit with a shell and handicapped for a little while and overcame that. His letters from Halifax and his letters from the University of Michigan, and I just got really, really lucky.
All right, talk about this explosion, December 6th, 1917 in Halifax Harbor. When you think about how big was it? Can you put that into context for us?
Yeah, this always stuns people that they had 6 million pounds of TNT and other high explosives on this ship. That's a bad idea. That is 13 times the weight of the Statue of Liberty on one ship. So you should not do that in the first place, but they were desperate. It's 1917. The Russians have left the war, so now the Eastern Front has been conceded to the Germans, and they're paranoid of the Germans rolling over the British, the French, and now the Americans who just joined the war. So you're overdoing this. Then, of course, you bump into another ship in Halifax Harbor. That's a bad idea. A fire starts. The crew takes off for the other shore, so no one is warned. And this ghost ship, now burning, slides perfectly into Pier 6 at the base of Halifax at 8:46 a.m. So people are walking to work, they're walking to school, the school children take a detour and go to watch this thing. Thousands are watching the ship burn, and at 9:04:35, it finally explodes. And in 1/15th of a second, less time than it takes to blink, half of Halifax is gone. 25,000 are homeless, about half the city. 9,000 are wounded. 2,000 are dead in a split second. It was one-fifth the power of the atomic bomb dropped on Hiroshima. And we know that because Oppenheimer, who's the master behind the atomic bomb, he studied this at a conference at Cal Berkeley in 1942. It's the only other comparison they had for the A-bomb. So that's how serious this was. That's the horrible news. And the great news happens afterwards.
Indeed. Getting back to where we were historically, as you say, World War I had been going on for more than 3 years. The U.S. had entered the fight that spring of 1917. How key was Halifax to the war effort?
Halifax was the conduit for almost everything from North America going to the Great War. That includes Americans and Canadian soldiers, almost all materials, food, supplies, munitions, relief supplies, you name it. Almost any British soldier not already in Britain was going to go through Halifax, as well as the Americans. So that was a crucial, arguably the most crucial port during World War One.
And history happens when you get two entities winding up in the same place at the same time, that one in a million thing. In this case, two ships, the SS Mont Blanc and the SS Emo. Now, tell us about them and why they were in Halifax Harbor that fateful morning.
Mont Blanc was going to Bordeaux, France, to turn that 6 million pounds of explosives into shells to bomb Germans.
And basically, as you say, loaded beyond the gills with incredible explosives to the point where the captain said, nobody can light a cigarette.
No one can even hold a match in your pocket. That's how terrified they were. They lined the hull with plywood to make sure there's no metal-on-metal contact because they knew that one spark could send them up. They secured the holds with copper nails because copper is one of the few metals that does not spark when struck. They feared that one spark, one rub, could send them all up. They lined their shoes, their boots, with canvas covers to make sure they didn't spark. So these guys in the ship knew that this was a floating time bomb, basically.
So they were pulling into Halifax Harbor?
They were pulling into Halifax Harbor, and they think after 4 days by themselves, no convoy, from New York, Brooklyn, New York, to Halifax, they think, okay, finally we're safe. Relax. And they went through not one, but two metal gates underwater, which kept the U-boats, the German submarines, out of the harbor. So you're finally in. You're dying to get in here. It's 8:45 in the morning. The Emo, the Norwegian relief ship, was already a day late because of the same fences. The fences kept them from getting out the night before. So they're in a rush to go out. That captain is a hothead, which we make clear in this thing. So he's a problem, and he does not have any idea what Mont Blanc has on it.
Why is that? You'd think there would be warning flags.
One warning flag means the German U-boats just outside Halifax Harbor have you as a sitting duck. So about five guys in the whole harbor had any idea what was on the ship.
Okay. So
there's your problem.
There's your problem, because it really is a Murphy's Law.
One thing after the other. And safeguards, some of them stupidly, the protocols were removed because, you know, they're in a haste. It's World War One. Guys are dying overseas, left and right. So the British Crown did not care that much what's happening in Halifax. They're worried about their guys getting mowed over in the trenches of Europe.
Isn't this a big harbor? How did these two wind up bumping up? Bumping
it's a big
together?
Harbor, except for one part called the Narrows, which are in fact narrow. It's all of a sudden only 1,000 feet across for about a mile, 18-mile-long harbor. It's the second biggest natural harbor to Sydney, Australia. It's a great harbor. But now you've got two ships trying to get out, get past each other in this 1,000-foot-wide Narrows, and the one ship, the Emo, keeps on ignoring the rules and going to the left and to the left and to the left of each successive ship. This is the same as driving a car on a two-lane road. You want to pass on the left, you better know what you're doing because there'll be a car coming by on the right. That car, in this case, was Mont Blanc.
Oh, boy. So they bump.
They bump. It's a game of chicken, and finally at the last second, Mont Blanc says this guy's crazy and he's not going to get on the correct side. So they try to peel off the last second, as we would on the highways, and try to peel off left. So does the Emo at the last second. So they bump, and it's not a big bump, but it's a big enough bump to knock over the airplane fuel on top. They had unwittingly constructed the perfect bomb with a fuse on top and the heavy explosives down below.
So it starts to burn, and the crew of the Mont Blanc, as you say, they knew what was going on. They got off that ship and paddled to safety, didn't they?
They had two rowboats, 20 people each, and they went the other direction to Dartmouth, Nova Scotia, across the Narrows.
And so here's this ghost ship.
This ghost ship now, which no one knows what's on it.
And the whole town's like, there's a ship burning. I can just see this.
Burning.
Let's go see. Let's go see.
It's exciting. And the war seems so far away, they don't imagine what's on it. So that's, and the timing is cruel, like I said, because everyone's going to work and to school. The stoves from breakfast are still burning in every home in Halifax, which is going to matter.
And the kind of explosion, I mean, you take us to that moment. Give us a for instance. You have so many victims of this explosion. What story really hit you hard?
As far as the power of it, my grandfather's story on the 2,000-pound anchor being flown 2 miles, that got my attention. Windows were blown out 50 miles away. And again, the whole town is just flattened. If you were standing within a quarter mile of it, you were flown a quarter mile up the hill. and you had no idea what just happened to you. But all of a sudden, you're at a new park, Needham Park, on the top of the hill of Halifax. So you're watching it 1 second. Next second, you've got black grime all over you. You're wet from the tidal wave that happens afterwards, a 35-foot tidal wave, which drowned those who survived, the first thing. And no one can believe what's happening. And the look of bewilderment was repeated often by people. No one was screaming or yelling. They're walking around like zombies, like, what has just happened?
And people vanished, didn't they? Some of them, never to be found, no trace.
There
are
about 600 people we have no idea what happened to.
What kind of injuries, John, were most common?
Sad to say, facial wounds, because the town, it's like a miniature San Francisco. They got these beautiful homes, two-story homes, with bay windows, because their bay is beautiful, so they've all faced the bay. Everyone went to the bay windows and their workshops and so on to watch the Mont Blanc burn. Back then, there's no safety glass. This is the thin-paned stuff. So when they're watching, the facial wounds occur. About 300 or 400 were blinded during this process. And my great aunt, Aunt Ruth, lived in Halifax for a while. And you were taught when you grew up in Halifax in the 20s and 30s, if you see somebody with one of these blue-tinged facial scars, that's from the TNT itself, you are told to not stare because that's the explosion. So this went on for decades.
There was, amidst all of this disaster, you bring us some very special moments of human kindness, including a barbershop story.
And what's great about this is, obviously, a disaster you're never going to forget, but they remember the human kindness as much as anything else. And one beautiful little example among many in this book, Noble and Gordon Driscoll, 10 and 12 at the time, they go about an hour away for a haircut, because that's what we have to go for a haircut. That's where they're recovering. Mom gives them $1 to go in for a haircut. This is a week after the disaster. Okay. They still have glass shards, little bits of glass and wood in the back of their heads. So the barbers are cutting their hair and trying to get the oil out of their hair, which is very stubborn. And when the kid winces, when Noble winces, the barber says, ah, you must be from Halifax. He knows immediately. He goes over to the other barber and they whisper to each other, unbeknownst to the two kids. They go back and tell all the other customers, we're not open today, got to go away. They give the kids two shampoos to make sure they get the oil out. They pull out all the little glass shards and wooden chips. And afterwards, Noble's getting very nervous because all he has is a dollar. And that will not pay for two shampoos and all the extra attention. He gives the barber a dollar, feeling embarrassed and a bit sheepish. And the barber waves it off and smiles. And with the other barber, they go across the street to a clothing store and buy the kids a new wardrobe because all their clothes are gone, except for what they're wearing. So, and 80 years later, what we remember is the barber. 100 years later now, that barber whose name I don't know, but that act of kindness lives on forever. And I think that's really, really cool.
I'm speaking with John Eubacon about his latest book, The Great Halifax Explosion, a World War I story of treachery, tragedy, and extraordinary heroism. And let's talk about that heroism, just like we saw after 9/11 when people and nations really came together, put aside differences to stand as one against a tragedy. There really was a coming together after the Halifax explosion, wasn't there?
No question. And it's true heroism. It really is. And it's from everybody. It's common people doing uncommon things. Just your neighbor all of a sudden going down into a basement to save a neighbor's baby. It is soldiers going into burning homes to get cats out, for crying out loud. It's again and again and again. The extraordinary heroism came from ordinary people. And we saw a lot of this during 9/11. This is on actually a grander scale, because those are two towers that the firemen go up and that's about it. This is all over town. This goes on for about a day and a half, this endless burning. So a 14-year-old girl is one of our heroes. Joseph Barge, we'll get to, is one of our heroes as well. And it's really inspiring. So those of you who are tired of disasters, it's about a quarter of it is set up. Middle third or so is the explosion. And then the last, whatever that leaves, my math is off. almost a third or so, more than a third, is how the city and the people responded, including the Americans.
Yes, because there were testy relations, as you point out. We get a good history lesson into the formation of Canada, and things were a little testy, but particularly the city of Boston stepped up.
Really quite amazing. And look, I grew up with more Canadian history than most, given my mom being a Canadian native. I had no idea that we were not allies at all in 1917. In 1776, when the start of the war, that side of my family, including 60,000 other American colonists, went to New Brunswick and Nova Scotia. The American side of me calls them the scaredy cats.
Yeah.
The Canadian side is the United Empire Loyalists.
That's right.
So they basically founded New Brunswick and Nova Scotia, essentially. So they had no great feelings towards the U.S. In 1812, it's the Canadians versus the Americans, essentially, as well as the British, of course. The guy tried to burn down the presidential mansion, and he failed. He tried to burn it down, but it's made of white stucco, so you can't get very far with it. But it blackened it, and that forced them to whitewash it, which is why it's called the White House. That guy is buried with honor in the center of Halifax. So, and then you got Joseph Bars, the world's greatest privateer at the time in Canada. He sunk, captured, or burned more than 60 American ships, the most wanted man in America. And he was finally caught in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, where they walked him up and down Main Street and fed him hardtack for 2 months.
A perp walk.
A perp walk. Yeah, the world's first perp walk, probably, I suppose. So we were not allies, even in the Civil War. Half of Halifax supported the Confederates, and with great danger they did so, because they wanted the cotton. In 1911, I can't believe this either, the Speaker of the House of the United States, the Paul Ryan of his day, got on the floor of U.S. Congress to vociferously advocate for the annexation of Canada, and he received cheers and a glowing report from the Washington Post. 1911, American leaders were talking about annexing Canada. So we are not allies.
But Boston stepped up to a point where it's even recognized today.
It is recognized today in no small terms. Boston, they're still shipping towns. And even though they're at war for basically 100 years, when it happened, the Massachusetts governor, Samuel McCall, without even being asked, they send 2 trains, 2 ships, 100 doctors, 300 nurses, all the supplies you could ever imagine to run a couple hospitals for a few weeks at about $1 million of supplies, which is $20 million today, without being asked. And you talk to any of the survivors in the 70s or 80s, late in their life, the first thing they always mentioned was the help from Boston. And it turned, by the way, U.S. and Canada into allies. That's where it starts. The Halifax is so appreciative. To this day, they spend $180,000 to find their best spruce tree in the entire province, 50 feet high or so. Usually a private citizen. They've got a cutting ceremony. They load it on a truck. They send it 600 miles down to Boston. They raise it in Boston Common for the holidays. They light it in a big ceremony. It costs them $180,000, and no Bostonians, or very few, have any idea why they're being thanked. But as a Haligonian, as they're called, said, they said, why should we stop thanking them? Which to me is such a great spirit and so counter to what we see internationally right now.
Indeed.
This is how people are supposed to get along.
And other things too. Medicine? There were medical advances made because of what was encountered in the aftermath?
Ophthalmology, eye surgery was greatly advanced because you had all these doctors in town who spread best practices. And as I said, there are hundreds of blinded people from Halifax. Pediatric surgery. A guy named Dr. Ladd from Boston came up and he realized during the burn victims, the kid burn victims in Halifax, that you have to approach this differently than you do adult burn victims for various reasons. He goes back to Boston, has a 2-bed clinic, and from that he gets a whole wing. Talk to any pediatric surgeon, and they'll tell you the father of pediatric surgery is Dr. Ladd, and he learned it in Halifax.
And then, astoundingly, the great Halifax explosion, as you say, has a direct connection to men's hockey at the University of Michigan.
This is my favorite of the stories, as you might imagine.
I can guess. But, yeah, all things do come down to University of Michigan.
Of course they do. Why shouldn't they? But that privateer I mentioned, yes, who sunk 60 and burned and captured 60 American ships, his great-grandson also grew up not liking Americans too much. He fought in World War I. He's all gung-ho about it. He got hit with a shell, came back to learn how to walk again in Halifax when the boat blew up. And he knows first aid. So by the end of the weekend, he is basically performing surgeries he has no business performing, but it's all hands on deck, 9,000 wounded.
Because he'd been on the battlefield in World
War I.
Exactly,
and you got 9,000 wounded, so what can you do?
Yeah.
That's when he realizes, I don't want to be a businessman in Montreal, which he was, making good money. I don't want to be a soldier. I don't want to be a pastor like my father. I want to be a doctor. I want to heal people, not kill them. And his uncle gives them $100 and says, go to the University of Michigan. And I'm not quite sure why. His cousin was there in surgery, so perhaps that was it. He comes to Ann Arbor. He marries a woman from Battle Creek, an American. He becomes an American citizen because the Bostonians so impressed him. He said, I've changed my view forever about Americans based on Boston. Becomes a citizen, goes down to Fielding Yost's office, the athletic director at the time, and says, you need a hockey program. He said, only if you're the first coach. So while a med school student, while married, he starts the hockey program. It has now won 9 national titles, which is a national record. It starts with the Halifax explosion.
You put a lot of work, a lot of time into telling this story, and I can tell it has really grabbed you and moved you.
It has, and even writing it, I got choked up a few times. People have already read it in the early going, you included, have gotten choked up a few times. It's a story about disaster, but how people respond to the disaster, and these people ended up living very good lives. That's incredible. They lost, you know, 5 siblings, and it's horrible, obviously, and they find ways to pick themselves up, and people who have interviewed them say they have such great perspective. They are so patient. This is before they passed away, obviously, in the 70s and 80s, and they're so good-hearted. And that's the lesson of this whole thing, is that no matter what happens to you in this world, somehow they have found a way to live good, productive, contributing lives.
A lesson for the ages. John Eubakin, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. And one quick note, Today's show featured a couple of interviews that aired previously on Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening.